Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, and thank you, Lizzie, for this very timely and important conference on the extractive industries on federal lands. And, you know, I'm going to let the moderator, who I'm about to introduce in a second, take control of the panel, and there's a lot to talk about. But I'm struck, as I think about what this panel has before them and what we're about to hear, about just how many different areas of the law this touches. And this particular semester, I'm teaching property law for the first time. And yes, I've suffered through rule against perpetuities, Caitlin, I see in the audience, and future interests and possibilities of reverters and reversions and all those types of things. But as I've been thinking about the topic that this panel is going to challenge, fundamental precepts of property law are being challenged. Our concept of what is nuisance, the different values between property owners, what Congress is going to do with their powers to manage and control of federal lands and waters, and even the Fifth Amendment, takings and eminent domain issues, fundamentally changing how we deal and look at property law. And if that's occurring, then the activity driving all this obviously must be something big. And I can think of, I've just met John this morning, but he has an incredible, impressive bio, which should be, if you have the packet out front, I won't read it to you, but he's with General Electric. He is a global director of their water and power, does all sorts of incredibly fascinating things relating to technology, to economics, to law and policy. It's really, I'm delighted to welcome him here today, and the panel is yours. Take it away.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, Lizzie, how do I get this first little video playing? Okay, thanks. Let me just say thank you. It's great to be here at AU. I'm John Friedman. I am based here in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to start with a question. So how many in this room watch House of Cards? Has anybody seen the first episode of season 3 yet? Yeah. Is it any good? I haven't seen it. Okay, I'm looking forward to it. So let me see if I can launch this, Lizzie. The cone? Okay, we're going to start with an important video.
I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office.
Power is not like real estate. It's all about location, location, location. The closer you are to the source, the higher your property value. Centuries from now, when people watch this footage, who will they see smiling just at the edge of the frame?
So, congratulations.
Okay, so I'm not trying to imply anything about how important I am by this photo. I'll let you draw your own conclusions. But let me just say this is, of course, completely photoshopped from the green ball, which I went to for President Obama's inauguration. I also have a fist bump with him. Look, because of the application of an old technology, in other words, hydraulic fracturing, but in a new way, horizontal drilling, we now have a completely unexpected 283-year global supply of cheap natural gas. And I just want to say this. GE does not frack. I think a lot of people think that we're in the oil and gas drilling industry. We are a technology provider. And when Senator Dianne Feinstein said to me, John, I don't think GE knows all the risks of fracking, when it's out there drilling for oil and gas. I said, Senator Feinstein, we don't drill for oil and gas, but my friend from Chevron does. And I let him respond to the questions about risks. But we do sell drilling equipment. We sell water treatment equipment for the flowback and produced waters. We sell compressed natural gas stations. And look, we're here to talk about oil and gas development on natural lands. Let me just say this. Traditionally, in the United States, oil and gas development is a core state responsibility. You know, I keep saying fracking. Why? There were 38,000 natural gas wells drilled in the United States last year. Does anybody know how many of those were fracked? Anybody want to guess? 34,000. So when I talk about incremental oil and gas development in the U.S., I'm really talking about fracking right now. And I think it's happening so fast in so many places that states are really struggling to keep up from a policy standpoint. There's tremendous concern, I think, from the standpoint of public health and also just protecting the environment. And you see New York State, I don't know if anybody saw this, but I don't know, was it 3 or 4 weeks ago? Governor Cuomo just banned fracking effectively. That's a really, I think, important development. California just passed a new fracking law. North Dakota, an oil and gas state, but they're very concerned about flaring. So the states are looking at policy issues all over the board. And one of the things that GE did just this past June was we released a menu of policy options for government officials who are looking to put in place policies that will help protect the environment and public health. And we identified 123 policy good practices where you can balance a safe, responsible way to develop oil and gas resources while also allowing for the economic development of those resources. This white paper is available to anyone who's interested. And I do want to say, of course, there is a federal role, particularly on federal lands. And EPA, of course, plays a major role, and EPA is about to release a new regulation, effluent limit guideline for frac water treatment. The Department of Energy has a role as it relates to LNG exports. Of course, the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Land Management in particular is developing regulations for fracking on federal lands. And even Congress plays a role in developing legislation related to oil and gas development. And we have a lot of experts to talk about these federal issues today. And I want to start with Jill Lewandowski. Jill is chief of the Environmental Consultation Branch for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. And like me, Jill is a UVA grad. And I'm just going to briefly introduce everyone. Anybody see the UVA-Syracuse game last night? And we have Elizabeth Schuster, who's senior legislative and policy analyst for the water program at Food and Water Watch. And I imagine, Elizabeth, you'll have some thoughts about protecting water supplies. And we have Matt Lee Ashley. Matt is director of public lands at the Center for American Progress. You know, and he was also deputy chief of staff to Ken Salazar at the Department of Interior. So, Matt, I think you'll likely have some very good insights to the issues on federal lands from a Bureau of Land Management standpoint. Also, I'll just note that in Matt's bio, there are three words you'll never find in my bio, summa cum laude at Pomona College. Well done. And then we have Brett Marston. Brett's an attorney at Arnold and Porter, also with a word in his bio you'll never find in mine, valedictorian at Davidson College. Again, well done, Brett. Oh, and four other words you'll never find in my bio, order of the coif at Georgetown Law Center. And why don't we start, Jill, with you. Now, let me see if we can get your charts up for you. Yeah, I don't know where it is.
It's on the...
I'll tell you what. I'll go.
Used to a computer.
Okay, Lizzie will do it.
Okay.
Well, while we're getting that pulled up, I'll start with a little bit of an explanation of who I am and the bureau that I work for. So my name is Jill Lewandowski, and I work for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. Essentially, we handle the federal waters, so anything from 3 nautical miles out to our exclusive economic zone, about 200 nautical miles. And, you know, and we deal with not just oil and gas, but we also deal with renewables as well as sand and gravel, marine mining, a lot of sand that renourishes beaches either for tourism or for like sea turtle nesting habitat. Some of that comes from the offshore environment, and we also manage the leasing of those areas and the collections of those sands. Oh. Hang on. Now, I wanted to mention one thing. So BOEM is on the left side there, and it describes what our general mission statement is. And I wanted to include a sister agency of ours, BESI, Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. And they're on the right side there, and I'll explain what the difference is. Both of us work under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, and we both deal just with federal water. So anything on those programs that I mentioned that happens in state waters is a state issue. We don't manage any of the state waters. But BOEM, basically, we do sort of the handle the sort of searching, the exploring. We handle the leasing, and we handle some of the initial sort of development of those leasing. And there's a lot of pieces that are very complicated that go along with that. You know, once somebody is on and is producing and through decommissioning, that's when BESI comes in. BESI is sort of they ensure that companies are complying with the conditions that BOEM requires. There's a lot more that each agency does beyond that, but basically BESI provides that oversight. And that is something that was created post-Deepwater Horizon when they split the existing agency, Minerals Management Service. They split at the time in order to, you know, have two separate agencies regulating the same action, but also to sort of reinforce and build capabilities for that oversight. Now, I wanted to mention we deal with the Outer Continental Shelf. Again, I mentioned that was 3 nautical miles. In some states it's a little different. Out to 200, it's about 1.7 billion acres. And that's what we have oversight over. And, of course, those are federal lands, so they're owned by everybody. The government just has the ability, under certain circumstances, to lease particular areas of it, either for renewable energy, to gather sand, or for oil and gas development. But it's a particularly large area, but there's only very discrete areas of that are actually being leased right now for oil and gas. And pretty much what we have out there for leasing, I think it's the latest figures are about 5% of what we've leased on the Outer Continental Shelf is our nation's use of, is 5% of the natural gas input for our nation is from the OCS, and it's about a little over 20% of the gas. And most of that gas development is in the Gulf of Mexico. So I mentioned the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. I put up there, you know, basically in a synopsis in red of what the goal of that is. And I do want to really reinforce that it's not just managing the development, but it's doing it in a safe as well as an environmentally sound manner. My opinion is that largely that is accomplished, but as we all know, there are times that there are accidents and spills that do happen, and I'm very willing and open to discuss any questions anybody has about that. Now, I wanted to focus this particular presentation since we just have a bit of time, and I wanted to pick an area, so I picked the Atlantic, and I wanted to bring up two things that are going on right now that BOEM is considering as far as oil and gas development in the Atlantic. The first bullet there is geophysical surveys. And basically what geophysical surveys do, and I'll talk about them in a minute, but they just look for that resource potential. So that's the first step, that they actually sort of take a like a sonogram, an image of what's underneath the seabed and where there are potential resources. There are other types of geophysical surveys that are also used before anybody, whether it's planting a wind turbine or putting, you know, platform legs down into the sand. There are things that are done to be sure that there are no archaeological resources there, like shipwrecks or cultural resources, and also like gas pockets and things like that could be hazardous if you were to sort of punch into it. The second thing that I'm going to talk about today is the five-year program. The OCSLA does require us to basically plan out every 5 years what areas we may potentially offer for leasing. Right now, we're developing our 2017-2022 program, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit, about what that entails. And that's another opportunity for all of you to engage in that process and provide input as well. And I also wanted to point out that we do not, as an agency, we do not actually run the seismic. That is done independently by companies who submit permits. But what we do is we get all that data, because what we want to be sure happens is that if a lease is offered, we've seen the same data, probably more data than all the companies, because often they will purchase specific data, but we get everybody's data. So we can look at that, determine what we think the resource potential is, and make sure that the government and the taxpayers and American people are getting fair market value for whatever is leased. All right, I'm just going to have to keep doing this the old-fashioned way since. Also wanted to point out here, I work in the Office of Environmental Programs, and, you know, there's not a lot of time today to talk about everything that we do in order to try to ensure that, you know, risks are minimized to the maximum extent possible. We have not only the part that I work in that brings the science and assessment together and does all the evaluations, we also have a pretty robust science program. Is about $35 million a year that go to studies that range from physical oceanography to study currents. That can then feed into an oil spill risk model to actually give us an idea if oil were spilled in a certain area where it might land. We also do a lot of protected species research. We do a lot of research with about shipwrecks and cultural resources that are submerged. And so it ranges, and we also do a lot of socioeconomic research as well. And also, as we're looking in the Arctic, we're also working with trying to bring traditional knowledge and doing a number of studies into our assessments as well. Now, you know, I'm sure most of you, since an Environmental Law Society, most of you are familiar with NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act. At any given point, there's about 30 different statutes that can govern or have a place, a role in how any sort of oil and gas development is explored, same as renewables or marine minerals. I've listed some of the key ones up there, certainly because of the noise issues that come into play from some of these sources, some of these activities. Marine mammals, Marine Mammal Protection Act is a big one, Endangered Species Act. Pretty much everything up there is something that we spend a lot of time in. And we work with other agencies as well, since largely some of these are their mandates. And so we work with them to do the evaluations, and they will tell us what additional things we need to consider. And I've just sort of listed some example of the potential effects that we look at. You know, when we go through an assessment, those are some of the big ones. It can be different depending on a particular project. There may be some additional ones that are added, but that's generally the main ones. Also, what we try to do, and this is set up under the OCSLA, is we try to do a very tiered effort. So we start, you know, at the five-year program, which I'm going to talk about in a second. So this is a very broad scale. So the analysis is at a broader scale. And that analysis, again, is NEPA and all those statutes that I just showed you. Then if something is going to be leased, we do a lease sale evaluation, and we do all those analyses again, but focused on that lease area or anything related to that lease area. So again, another NEPA, all those environmental consultations as well. if they get a leased area and they get to a point where they want to explore, they kind of want to do some exploratory drilling, they have to submit a plan, and we do it all over again. We look at what's in the plan, we do the NEPA, all the consultations again, and it's getting more specific to the actual site that they're going to explore. And certainly in production, if they want to put something out there and produce, same thing. They have to submit a plan. We go through all the environmental analysis again. And as it shows here, you know, it takes, you know, it gets more specific as you move down through the levels. And I would like to point out, even if something is leased, it's often 10 years or so, 8 to 10 years, until you actually would see anything that leads to production. Also, a lot of times, they may get to the exploration phase and not find anything that is economically viable, and that's kind of where it ends. So when we issue our leases, it's for 10 years. And if they haven't been able to show that they can produce off of that within that time, then the lease expires. So now just a couple slides to go into the two things I want to mention about what's happening in the Atlantic right now. You may have heard news reports or maybe even read some of the documents that we've produced. But we have a number of companies that are interested in going out there and doing seismic surveys. Those are surveys that use air guns, and I'm going to show you a visual in a second. And those are obviously of concern from a couple standpoints, noise being one of them. Others are concerned because they feel like that's the first step to oil and gas. What it really is meant to do, though, is to explore what the potential is out there. Is there potential? And you can't really know that aside from going out and drilling holes in the ground or doing seismic. And seismic is a way that you're not actually disturbing the bottom. But both things have their positives and their negatives. There are no Atlantic sales that are have happened or in place in our current program. There was one that was in there, but it was taken out after Deepwater Horizon, so we could study what happened in Deepwater and get a better idea of what additional protections needed to be put in place. Since then, though, we had, you know, 8 companies and 9 permit requests to explore the Mid and South Atlantic. We did a programmatic environmental impact statement under NEPA, as well as many of those consultations you saw. And it basically outlined from a programmatic standpoint what we felt had to be in there as far as mitigation and environmental protections. And we're now at the phase where we're looking at each of those individual applications and going through that same analysis again and ultimately deciding whether or not we will approve it, a seismic survey to go forward. At the same time, these companies also have to go to the National Marine Fisheries Service and get an authorization under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And there's, of course, a number of other things that have to be done. But there's some websites up here that can lead you to some more information about that permitting. And just to give you an idea here, if you look at the bottom, so basically a seismic survey, like here's the vessel. Here's the seismic array. And then they tow these streamers that have hydrophones behind them. And I'm not sure anybody who's doing this remotely can see what I'm pointing to. But basically, the sound is directed largely downward. It does spread out horizontally to some extent, largely downward. But it needs to be powerful enough to get into the seabed and fairly deep at times. And then it bounces off what's in there, and it comes back up, and it's received in these hydrophones. And so they'll get a picture of this, and the more they develop the seismic in the airgun technology, it gets even more more apparent. Now, I'm not a geologist or a geophysicist, so this doesn't look like much to me, but it means a lot to the folks who understand what these different layers mean. So what these surveys will do, they'll take these arrays, and this is an example up in the Arctic, but they'll have these track lines that they follow, and they've basically designed this based off of whatever they're needing to try to investigate. And they'll follow these track lines, and they'll run these seismic air guns over those track lines. Now, in the Atlantic, These are basically are polygons of the nine different survey requests that we have. So they each of these outlines the overall area that a company wants to explore in the Atlantic. And again, these are things that we're contemplating now, and we actually do have some public meetings coming up on the mid and South Atlantic in order to discuss those with the public. When I talked about the programmatic EIS, we included in there some standard mitigations for the use of air guns that are used worldwide. Those largely mean you establish like a zone around the vessel where you think there's a potential for injury to marine mammals, and you have experienced observers that watch or listen acoustically, put a hydrophone in and listen. And, they will basically shut down if a marine mammal comes near that zone, and then they have to clear it for a while before they can start up again. We did do a 20 nautical mile buffer or exclusion zone where air guns cannot operate, and that's because it's the main migratory corridor of the North Atlantic right whale. We added an additional buffer to that where no sound can go into this yellow area that could be potentially disturbing. So they have to model out how much further they need to be away in order to make sure what sound goes into here is not going to be of a level that could disturb right whales. Now, this doesn't get every right whale, but it is the main migratory corridor and the bulk of what we know about how they do migrate. We also have a sea turtle closure area where they can't operate. We're requiring passive acoustic monitoring. So, again, they're listening for marine mammals as well as watching. And there's also some additional site-specific mitigations that may be added at the individual survey level, and that's kind of what we're going through right now. There may be an area, a time of year they have to avoid. Perhaps there's a potential multi-use conflict with the fishery. So those are all the sorts of things that we'll look at in this next stage. Now the second and last thing I wanted to bring up is we are engaged in starting the 2017 to 2022 program. What this program will do at the very end, and it's a 2+ year process to get there, is it will come up with a list of sales, where they're located, and generally when in the program they would occur, but there's still potential at that time. Not until you have a lease sale does it actually happen, and there are times that lease sales are pulled off of the plan. The key thing, though, is if it's not in this plan, when we finish it in about 2 years, it can't be added in without redoing the whole thing. So right now, it starts broader. The draft proposed plan just came out at the end of January. It starts broader, so all these areas in yellow could be offered up for potential leasing, and we're going to focus in on the Atlantic in a second. If it's a different color here, it's because it's a deferral or withdrawal area, meaning nothing can happen in those areas. Gulf of Mexico, we tend to do leasing where companies are interested because it is more developed there. But when you get into like the Atlantic or certainly the Arctic, we're going to have more targeted leasing, meaning we're going to pick very specific spots where we would consider. And as we move through development of this plan, and it has various stages and various stages for public input, you'll start to see things focusing more and more into certain areas. Now, looking at the Atlantic, right now the plan has one sale in 2021, so further in the plan, so there's more time to develop environmental information. And it can only at this point be somewhere within this yellow area. The plan does have a 50-mile buffer from the coast, so nothing can happen in there. And again, and it only goes from just south of Maryland there until the line of Georgia. And again, nothing that's not on here can be added. In the next stage of this plan that you'll see come out in early 2016, we'll have even a more fine-tuned focus over what potential lease sale may be offered. Leases are done in blocks that are basically 3x3, and there could be like a series of blocks. I think the last one that was offered that was taken off the table in Virginia was a little triangle size, if you can see my cursor, about that big. Doesn't mean that's what happens, where this one is going. I honestly don't know. It depends a lot on input from the public, but that gives you an idea of the scale. And then here, you know, there is a public comment period that ends on March 30th. These websites can get you. There is a public comment period on the program itself, and that's what I just showed you, as well as the scoping period on the EIS. Those two things are run concurrently because we do want the environmental review to be independent of the development of the program, but they do link together, and they're both used as decision documents by the Secretary of Interior ultimately to decide what goes into the final plan. So there's a lot of information up there about how you can submit comments. On our PAS website, we even have a geo portal where you can pull up a map, you can circle areas, you can write on it where what you're concerned about and attach it with your comments. And we really encourage folks to, you know, if you're interested and these issues are important to you, particularly now early in the scoping process for the PEIS, is an opportune time to provide that input, because the next step is going to be developing alternatives that we're going to consider. No action will be one alternative. The draft proposed plan I just showed you is another. And then we'll have a series of other ones that we largely select from the public comments we get during scoping. And then we're going to come back in early 2016 with the next version of the proposed program, as well as the draft EIS. That gets put out for public comment again, and all that will happen before it gets finalized. So I think that's my last slide. Again, I just really encourage you, if you're interested in these issues, you can ask me questions, come talk to me, but we do have some great opportunities right now where you can provide some great input. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jill. And listen, hold your questions. We're going to get through the four presentations, and then we'll have a Q&A. And Elizabeth Schuster, why don't you share the Food and Water Watch perspective with us? I think your charts are now up.
Okay. Great. So what I wanted to talk about is sort of, you know, what Food and Water Watch is and where we're coming from and what makes us unique to with regards to what's going on public lands. And we've just started this Protect Our Public Lands from Fracking campaign. So I'll give you an overview of what we are, and then I'll talk more specifically about what's going on next and where it is right now. I can figure out. Oh, okay. So Food and Water Watch is a national consumer advocacy organization that works to ensure our food, water, and fish we consume are safe, accessible, and sustainable. And one of the things that you'll find in our mission statement, which I think makes us stand out a lot, from other organizations, is we work to stop corporations that are putting profits above people. And that's a core value in all of our campaigns. So if you look at our values, we have four core values that go and also apply to all of our campaigns that we work on. And the first one is independence. And independence means that we don't take money from any corporate interests. So our membership funds us, so members, individual donors, or foundations. Democracy, we really work to organize local groups and local individual people to get involved in their democracy, both on a local level and on a national level. And human rights, we come from the perspective as an organization that water is a human right and not a commodity to be bought and sold. And finally, we believe in a sustainable future, and a sustainable future for Food and Water Watch is everything. Our common resources are accessible to all, and at the same time, we're protecting our environment. What makes us also unique as an organization when it applies to what's going on public lands and with fracking is that we actually have 17 field offices in 15 different states, from Maine to California. And those field offices comprise of organizers who both live and work to organize their local community. And as it's been mentioned before by others, you know, fracking is really a local issue that is now becoming in the national light. So a lot of the things that are going on with fracking are at a local level, and that's what makes our field offices and organizers so important. And the DC headquarters, where I work on the policy issues, mostly lobbying, is comprised of a lot of in-house researchers. So Food and Water Watch has its own researchers that do the research, produce the research to educate those organizers who are on the ground and get that education out to their local, to the localities. And we work on a lot of different issues, different program areas. So I just wanted to put them up there because they all overlap a lot of times. So when we're talking about fracking and we're talking about extracting on public lands, we also work a lot with our other. It goes across borders into our other programs. So. You know, I love this saying, organized people overcome organized money. And that's really what we're going for in a lot of our victories, is we're really trying to show people that if you organize strong enough, especially in the democracy and the current political spectrum that we're in now with money and politics, we really want people to still participate and submit comments, like Jill was saying, and really participate in their government. So hydraulic fracturing has a very technical definition, which I've put up here. But when we're talking about hydraulic fracturing, I think it's also important to realize that the definition, when I'm talking to people or on the Hill, has really become to mean so much more. It's often associated with a number of public health and environmental concerns. Oops. Going backwards. And it's really evolved into something so much more than even when I started at Food and Water Watch. And this is the latest poll from Pew on how people feel, specifically scientists, on where we are with increased fracking and how they're becoming more and more against increased fracking. So this slide really shows that majority of adults now, 51%, are opposed to increased fracking, 66% of scientists, so majority of scientists are opposed to fracking, and biologists and medical scientists, which I think is really, really telling, is 73% of them are against increased fracking. So why public lands and what's going on now specifically with public lands? Because Food and Water Watch really is calling for a ban on fracking, period, across the board. Not just on public lands. But what's going on now politically and why this is politically timely is the Bureau of Land Management has proposed some rules that came out in 2013. And they're now in the last step of being finalized, and we really expect them any day now. And when we organized against these rules, because when they came out, a lot of organizations felt they were very weak. Over a million comments were submitted by people, which, you know, is astounding. And over 650,000 of those comments called for a specific ban on fracking on public lands. Another thing that's going on right now, political atmosphere that was already mentioned as well, is this victory in New York. The Cuomo administration felt that fracking was entirely too unsafe to go forward in New York State. And a little victory, I'll call it a little V, was in Pennsylvania recently when the new Governor Wolf reinstituted a moratorium on fracking on their public parks and lands. So we started to look at, you know, what resonates with people and their public lands, these national treasures. And what we know so much more, but this is just a little bit of what we know that led us to really want to do something around specifically protecting our public lands from fracking. So 90% of federally managed lands are available for oil and gas leasing, while only 10% is reserved for conservation, recreation, wildlife, and cultural heritage. And as we mentioned before, you know, drilling and fracking comes with a lot of problems. Water contamination, air pollution, earthquakes, and methane leakage, which is catastrophic for climate change. And the workers on the fracking sites were also learning a lot about the working conditions and how they're exposed to toxic chemicals and unsafe conditions. And then even more telling, I think, is the Government Accountability Office, the GAO itself, in a report issued very recently, stated that a lot of the high priority wells, so the at-risk wells, the most at-risk wells, were not being inspected, and it was drilled from 2009 to 2012. So we took this information and we hit the hill, because right now, with everything going on a local level, we really wanted to do something that the grassroots could approach their representatives on and educate Congress. And the one thing that we really felt was significant about public lands is public lands are held in trust by the federal government for the people. And banning fracking on public lands is something that that Congress has the authority to regulate. So that's sort of what we did, is we went to the Hill and we worked with members of Congress, specifically Representative Pocan, and last December they introduced a bill, and I have the language if anyone's interested, that would, it's very simple, would ban fracking on public lands. And we plan on introducing that bill again in the spring. So, you know, our main goal with protecting public lands from fracking campaign is to bring attention to a lot of the issues, but for people to really get involved and bring what they're working on so closely on a local level to the national level, to go to the Hill and talk to their representatives and really educate them. Also, if you're interested, Maryland right now, in fact, as we speak, they're getting ready to host a rally at 12 o'clock to ban fracking in Maryland. There's a moratorium there that's been introduced. And so if you really want to see this on-the-ground effort, that's a good place to look since we're so close. And then there's an environmental film festival, and I just put the dates up there, where our executive director and our program of director for water will be there to answer any questions and to talk more about this. Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth. So, Matt, I'm going to invite you up here now, and maybe you can tell us how the Center for American Progress thinks about this issue.
You click this in advance. Great. Thanks, John. And thanks to Lizzie for helping organize this and inviting me, and Bill Snape and American University. It's a great panel to be on, and I appreciate folks' comments. The Center for American Progress is a nonpartisan think tank. We work to advance progressive ideas, not just on energy and environmental issues, but also on healthcare, foreign policy, national security, immigration, and a whole suite of issues. Today, I want to talk about some of the climate policy implications of federal land management decisions. And then I want to dive a little bit deeper into the federal coal program, because it's responsible for about 13% of all U.S. GHG emissions. But first, I want to underscore the importance of this particular forum. Federal land managers have a huge but underappreciated role in U.S. energy policy. People don't know what the Department of the Interior does. People don't know, really, that how much of our energy resources come from national forests, from Bureau of Land Management lands, from areas on the OCS that BOEM and BSEE help regulate and manage. And this was made very clear to me in 2012. I was working at the Department of the Interior at the time for Secretary Salazar, and federal agencies put a lot of work into trying to get their priorities and their accomplishments mentioned in the State of the Union. And it's not every year that the President will mention what you're working on in the State of the Union, but in 2012, the President did, and President Obama talked about, over the last 3 years, we've opened millions of new acres for oil and gas exploration. Tonight, I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources to development. Oh, great, the camera's going to pan to my boss at the time, Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar. Great, this is a wonderful moment. And sure enough, the camera panned to Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu. So the camera guy didn't get the memo, and it's not clear to me that in the media it's widely understood what the Department of the Interior does.
But the fact is that no federal agency, no federal department, has more direct control over U.S. energy resources than the Department of the Interior. More than 40% of U.S. coal comes off federal land. Crude oil production on federal lands and waters was under 20% of U.S. total production until the late 1990s, but it rose to more than 30% in the early 2000s and reached a high of about 37% in 2010. Natural gas production from federal lands accounted for around 30% of all gas production from the 80s to the 2000s. That has declined in the last few years because the markets and economics have changed a bit. And then on the renewable energy front, just in this administration alone, there have been 50 utility-scale renewable energy projects and associated transmission projects approved on federal lands since 2009, including 27 solar, 11 wind, and 12 geothermal projects. And so there's a huge ramp up in renewable energy production on federal lands and an effort led by BOEM and the Department of the Interior to move toward some utility-scale production offshore as well, primarily wind. And if the role of federal lands in U.S. energy policy is underappreciated, their role in U.S. climate policy is completely ignored. The Department of the Interior, all federal agencies have to do an accounting of their own GHG emissions that they're responsible for every year. And the Department of the Interior, the top thing that they claim is their biggest GHG emission impact comes from their vehicle fleet. So even the Department of the Interior does not acknowledge that there are climate implications broadly from their own energy management decisions, at least not in that particular report. I'm just going to tick through a few slides briefly that talk about some of the carbon pollution and GHG implications of federal land management decisions. This is coming from a report that we're going to release in a few days from the Wilderness Society. I think I mixed up the slides in order. So I'm going to jump around. I'm not quite sure what's next, so you have to bear with me here. Here's just the basic breakdown of where GHG emissions from public lands are coming from. Coal is 57%, a huge chunk. Oil and gas, this presentation, I'm even picking up the numbers. Oil and gas are smaller, and then you see kind of a mix of other sources, including coal bed methane. But coal is the big number there. We can see just in the last few years, we've done a couple of these reports now. There's been some fluctuations since 2010. And there's a couple interesting stories to tell here. I mean, first, this is really these changes since 2010, between 2010 and 2012, are mostly driven by production changes, so natural market shifts. It's really not driven by any sort of high-level policy decision from the climate side. But you do see onshore oil, emissions related to onshore oil are up, and that's primarily because of the boom in places like in New Mexico in particular, where a lot of there's a lot of unconventional oil production happening on federal lands in New Mexico. And then one slide that dropped off that I do want to mention briefly is that if you look at the GHG emissions related to energy development on public lands as a share of all U.S. Energy-related GHGs, it's about a quarter of all U.S. energy-related GHGs are coming from public lands, U.S.-managed public lands. And then the breakdown between onshore and offshore is about 23% of those are from offshore development, 77% from onshore. I want to talk briefly about two elements of this. Very briefly on methane. The numbers I mentioned in the first couple of slides, they don't include methane generally, with one exception. There's a big question right now about how much methane is coming from oil and gas activities on federal lands, private lands, state lands. Fugitive emissions, there's a lot of work going into trying to understand how much methane is leaking. We all know that methane has a much bigger climate impact than carbon even. But we did, in our little report that's coming out soon, we did use oil and gas industry reports of their own venting practices. So this is when there are voluntary releases of gas. And there have been some notable changes since 2008. This is broken between the offshore and the onshore. You notice a huge increase, what appears to be a huge increase in the offshore, and onshore has ticked up more generally. What happened in 2009 is really interesting. I think it was the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, MMS at the time, required installation of venting meters. So lo and behold, you get actually, it shows a big increase of vented gas and associated methane pollution. Well, that has to do with some smart regulation from the federal government. Onshore, the Bureau of Land Management does not require venting meters. So there's some basic technological changes that can be made to help both better measure some of the methane emissions coming from federal activities on public lands and then ratchet them down. And there is there are a couple rules in the works right now that should help on that front. And then briefly on coal, because the previous slide I put up there showed that coal accounts for 57% of all GHG emissions from energy activities on federal lands. Most coal production on federal lands happens in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming and Montana, more than 90%. The coal program has not been discussed widely in the last 30 years. There were some reforms made in the 70s and 80s, but it has largely been a program that has been out of sight and out of mind. Its purpose has been traditionally to maximize production of coal to help facilitate low electricity costs for Americans. But the coal program hasn't begun to take into account on a large scale, the carbon implications of leasing decisions. If you were to apply, for example, the social cost of carbon analysis from the federal government to federal coal, the carbon pollution costs from mining and burning coal from the PRB are around $62 a ton. Powder River Basin coal sells for about $12 a ton. So the PRB coal, if you were just looking at the social cost of carbon, is being mined at a net loss in value for taxpayers. And you might say, well, okay, well, the Clean Power Plan and some of these other policies relating to the climate policies that we're implementing can help address the carbon pollution implications of the federal coal program. But one of the big goals that coal companies have in the Powder River Basin now is to increase their exports of coal from federal lands. And there are some coal export terminal proposals on the West Coast I've recently had some troubles in getting approved, but if the three most recent ones were approved, it would result in an export activity about 130 million tons of coal that would likely go to the southeastern coast of China. It's about the equivalent of 35 million new passenger cars being added to the road. I think as you're thinking about federal land management, energy management policy. Oil and gas has been a big focus in the last few years. The offshore reforms have rightly gotten a lot of attention after Deepwater Horizon. I encourage you to think a little bit about the federal coal program because it has a huge impact both on energy supplies but also big climate implications. And then just broadly one comment here. I think the federal government has begun to think about how to address the climate implications of some of the decisions you'll see in NEPA analysis, in some of the planning work that's going on project level decisions, beginnings of discussions of global climate policy and the carbon implications of those decisions. What's really missing, it's hard to guide climate policy on a project-by-project basis or even individual plans by individual plans. At some point in time, I think we're going to see, or we need to see, the Department of the Interior broadly say, okay, let's take an accounting of our carbon footprint, a realistic one related to our energy production activities, and then how can the management of federal energy resources help us achieve not only our energy security goals and our environmental protection goals, but also our climate goals. And so what's really needed in our view is some sort of comprehensive carbon emissions reduction strategy for public lands. And there are a lot of tools that can be used to help achieve targets for carbon emission reductions, but that's missing, and I think that's an area that needs to be talked about and that we'll see more discussion of in the coming years. I think that's all I have at this point. So, thanks, John.
Thanks, Matt. I do want to talk to you more about the carbon reduction strategy. That's actually interesting, how you accomplish that on federal lands. But we'll wait for Q&A. And, Brett, maybe you can share with us the perspective of a practicing attorney.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Can you hear me okay? My name is Brett Marston. I'm an associate in the Environmental Practice Group at Arnold & Porter here in D.C. You might notice that for an associate, I'm a little long in the tooth. Law is sort of a second career for me. I started out in political science and taught for a couple of years. I didn't go to law school here at AU, but I do have a connection. You may know that my wife is in student affairs, Anita Padmanabhan. She might actually be in the audience as well. I think I might I might be in a little trouble tonight if I don't mention the following. I know Anita has been trying to set up meetings with students. In fact, her goal has been to contact every student at AU. I think she hasn't told me this, but she might give me grief if I don't encourage you to make those meetings. So, so Matt and I sort of, without coordinating, kind of had the same topic. I'm going to talk a little bit, talk mostly about coal, and I'm going to talk a little bit about those aspects of coal that, for which Matt didn't steal my thunder, some basic facts about coal leasing and coal policy. And then, because we're at a law school and because I'm a practicing attorney, I'm going to talk about a few cases that have been interesting in this area, including one that's going on at the District of the Federal District Court here in D.C. that you might be able to see some arguments in if you're lucky. So I think the main point that Matt made pretty well is that coal on federal lands is king, and this is not a well-appreciated fact, I think. The Energy Information Administration put out a report last year that I encourage you all to look at that broke down the sort of energy potential of various fossil fuels extracted from federal lands in the period 2003 to 2013. I think it's probably the same source that Matt was using for some of his slides. And if you look at just the sort of energy potential from coal, over that period, about 9 quadrillion British thermal units in the form of coal were extracted on an annual basis from federal lands under BLM management. For oil and gas, they're in a second place. In that period, gas production started out at about 7 quadrillion, ended up at about 4 quadrillion, and oil production fluctuated around between 3 and 4 quadrillion. So coal really is an important area of focus. And as Matt said, sales from federal lands, coal on federal lands makes up a very large production of total U.S. Coal production, about 40%. So, and as Matt also said, we really should have coordinated on our presentation, but I'm glad that he said it first, so you know it's true.
You say it better anyway.
Probably not. I don't have any slides, so you have to trust my words, but as Matt showed you, Wyoming is king in that area, followed by the Gulf of Mexico in terms of overall oil energy production. And Colorado and New Mexico are also up there, but they're sort of an order of magnitude behind Wyoming. And just to underline something that Matt also said, unlike the relatively comprehensive and extensive regional-based planning that happens on the OCS, coal leasing really happens on a sort of project-by-project or lease-track-by-lease-track basis. There is really no active, comprehensive federal coal leasing process on a regional basis. It was tried in the 70s and 80s, and due to lack of demand, it was stopped in 1990. So leasing decisions and environmental impact analysis are done essentially on a sort of project-by-project basis. It's a very small unit of analysis. So here are a couple cases for you. These are cases in which environmentally driven litigants have tried to make the connection between greenhouse gas emissions and coal production on federal lands. Some of you may have heard of them. The one where plaintiffs have had the most success recently is a case called High Country Conservation Associates out of Colorado. the opinion, if you're interested, it's number 113 CV 1723. Decision was from Colorado, District Colorado, in mid last year. And essentially what happened is there was a roadless area in Colorado and an underground mine adjacent to the roadless area, and the mine owners wanted to expand into that area. Both the BLM and the Forest Service had regulatory responsibilities over the approval of the expansion, and they approved the company's permit to expand the production. Plaintiffs had argued that the BLM and Forest Service had not adequately considered the costs of greenhouse gas emissions from this project, and the court agreed. Now, the court agreed for a variety of reasons that were probably rested on some pretty bad facts for the agency. One reason was that the agency had pleaded that it couldn't really estimate the costs of greenhouse gas emissions from the project. But it had done so, unfortunately, in the draft environmental impact statement for the project. So, and it also had estimated the benefits. So it had done a kind of quasi-cost-benefit analysis in the draft environmental impact statement, but when it came to the final environmental impact statement, the agency dropped out the discussion of the costs and only talked about the benefits. The court thought that was a little bit unfortunate. In fact, it was arbitrary and capricious. And so it overturned the decision partly on that grounds. And then secondly, the agency, according to the plaintiffs, should have considered the effects of the kind of downstream combustion of the coal that would come out of the project. The agency hadn't done that, saying it really couldn't predict these things. Couldn't predict these things because it didn't know enough about how particular plants would operate, and also, most critically, I think, the agency said that if the coal from this project wasn't in the market, market participants downstream would be able to substitute by picking up coal from other projects. And the court didn't find that persuasive, in part because the coal from this particular area was relatively cheap and relatively clean, and so perfect substitution should not be assumed. So, I think there are some couple takeaways here. If you're advising an agency, tell them don't do only half of the cost-benefit analysis. Don't just tally up the benefits. You got to do the whole thing. And also pay attention to this substitutability argument because it could be important. Just briefly, that case, in my view, High Country Conservation Advocates is really kind of a high watermark for plaintiffs. It rests partly on some bad facts for the agencies. Plaintiffs have tried to overturn individual leasing decisions. In the case, for example, Wild Earth Guardians versus Jewel out of the D.C. Circuit from 2013. Essentially, there was a similar kind of thing. There was a project where the mine owners wanted to expand onto federal lands, and the plaintiffs had said that the agency in approving the project hadn't taken into account the costs of the greenhouse gas emissions, but here the court was not persuaded. And it wasn't persuaded in part because what the plaintiffs had argued was that the Bureau of Land Management should have included analysis of the cumulative effects of this decision along with a bunch of other leasing decisions that were in the pipeline. Now, remember the unit analysis I was talking about earlier where, unit-by-unit analysis of environmental effects can be kind of difficult for plaintiffs. I think that's basically what tripped up plaintiffs in this case, that the agency sort of persuasively to the court said, we don't know if those other leasing decisions are going to happen. They're all kind of embryonic. We don't have to take them into account, and the court agreed. So environmental plaintiffs have kind of taken the lesson, and this is the final case I'll talk about. It's called WORC, Western Organization of Resource Councils versus Jewel, just filed in November of last year in the District of Columbia District Court. It's a much more ambitious suit than earlier suits, much more ambitious than Wild Earth Guardians. It aims at sort of a comprehensive approach to coal leasing, trying to fill the gap that I think Matt was saying exists in the policy, in the program. And the plaintiffs have been very sort of open about what their goals are in this lawsuit. In fact, there's a press release where the plaintiffs said that they believe ending the extraction of coal in the U.S. should be an important goal of climate policy. So consequently, they've asked the court to order the BLM to engage in a comprehensive review of the effects of coal leasing in general on greenhouse gas emissions. Now, there's a superficial plausibility to the case. You have to admit if you read the papers. The last time the Bureau of Land Management did a comprehensive review in the form of a programmatic environmental impact statement was in 1979, and it updated it in 1985, so 30 years have passed, and people know a lot more about how greenhouse gas emissions work in that intervening period. So the plaintiffs have said they have a duty to supplement given all this new information. Now, unfortunately, the plaintiffs likely have a relatively hard road ahead of them. As the U.S. has argued in its motion to dismiss that was recently filed, the PEIS that plaintiffs hang their hat on really have to do with actions that were kind of completed in the 70s. And there's no real kind of new federal agency action that would trigger the obligation to conduct a new PEIS. And part of that has to do with the statutory structure. I mean, on the OCS leasing program, it's statutorily mandated that you have this very sort of detailed and tiered approach. It just doesn't work like that under coal leasing. So just to wrap up, I think there are some takeaways. You know, coal is very important. Go to the D.C. District Court, hear these arguments if you're interested. It's not there before Judge Walton, not yet scheduled, but you might be able to see them. There is a significant litigation effort that's currently being expended to link up the costs of in terms of greenhouse gas emissions with federal coal leasing policy. The litigation will have some, probably doesn't have that much chance of success, but I think that if you ask the plaintiffs, their goal isn't necessarily to win the individual lawsuits, but to raise the issue and also to contribute to a broader discussion that may lead to greater regulatory actions in the future. So, and I should have said, did I say it at the start? These are my opinions, not the opinions of the firm or the firm's clients. So it's just me here. So, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett. So look, we're going to do a little Q&A, and then we'll spend a few minutes answering any questions you have about careers, career paths, that kind of thing. And I guess I want to start, I'll ask the first question, and then I'll turn it over to you. You know, I was kind of struck because, Elizabeth, I heard you talking about the Food and Water Works perspective that I think we can telescope into the statement that Food and Water Watch doesn't think that fracking can be done safely.
Right.
And then, Matt, I'm not sure it's your responsibility to answer this, but since you used to be Deputy Chief of Staff to Ken Salazar at DOI, I just want to say that I recall him saying, and I would say he's considered an environmentalist, but I recall him saying that fracking is a case where we can truly have our cake and eat it too. In other words, we can have access to this vast resource, natural gas, and we can access it in a safe, responsible way. So I guess what I'm wondering is there some way to reconcile those two positions? And then I'll just add one more thing. I know the Department of Energy had a commission to do a study on fracking to determine whether it could be done safely and responsibly. It was chaired by John Deutsch, who was former director of CIA and now is a professor at MIT. I think he's a chemistry professor. And, again, the panel at DOE concluded that fracking could be done in a safe, responsible way. I think recognizing it's an industrial activity, any industrial activity has some risk, but in the aggregate. So either one, if there's a response.
You want to start?
Or
you want me to start?
You can start.
So I would – the first thing I'd underscore is there are conflicting definitions of fracking, right? So – this was talked about a little bit earlier. The practice of actually fracking a well, you know, and injecting fluids down in horizontally and freeing up oil and gas supplies and bringing them out, from the industry's perspective, and others can speak to this, that's really the technical definition of fracking. For communities and for people who are experiencing oil and gas development in their nearby, I think fracking has now refers to the kind of aggregate of industrial development related to oil and gas development. So if you're in living near Greeley, Colorado, and you've seen this huge oil boom up there, and you see rigs coming closer to schools and houses, you're referring to, you know, you're concerned about the aggregate of environmental impacts related to that development, and that's now being referred to as fracking. And so there's a big disconnect between how industry and even in some regulators are talking about it and how communities that are experiencing the boom themselves are referring to this. That being said, I think there are some things that can be done to make the actual practice of fracking much safer. The Bureau of Land Management is promulgating a rule right now. It should be finalized very soon. That, and I'm not the technical expert here, but it basically does three things, or aims to do three things. The first is try to make sure that there's good well integrity, so when you are fracking that you're not losing fluids somewhere along the well casing. Secondly, that when that water comes back up, the flow back comes back up, that there's some way to deal with that, and there's a plan for treating the wastewater and making sure that that's not a pollutant that affects drinking water supplies. And then third, improving disclosure of the chemicals that are used. So if you're just looking at the practice of fracking, there are some very common sense things that can be done to improve that process. But the final thing, this has been said before, you can't make any of this 100% safe, right? Deepwater Horizon showed that as much as you at this, you're going to take a lot of environmental analysis and review and use the best science. These are human endeavors, and errors do happen. Human errors. There are technological errors. So you can't get something that is risk-free. But it's a question of balancing those risks and having decisions that use public input and the best science to make sure that we're comfortable with the risks that are being assumed.
Yeah, I mean, so from Food and Water Watch's perspective, it's inherently dangerous, right? And so we need to just get rid of the practice altogether. And when we talk about doing it safely, we have to remember that fracking is actually exempt from 7 out of our main bedrock environmental laws, including the Safe Drinking Water Act. So before you even start, and those loopholes have not been closed, so I think before you even start having that dialogue, you need to go back and you need to really look what's happening with regards to the law and closing these loopholes to put the gas and oil industry on the same platform as other industries. So I think that's number one. And I think that we really need, from Food and Water Watch's perspective, we're sort of going down the wrong path. We need an aggressive transition to renewables, and so going down this path of fracking and building all the infrastructure that has to do that in order to be successful is just the wrong way to go at this point with regards to what the science is telling us we need to do.
Would it be better to use natural gas as a bridge to renewables as opposed to, we've heard a lot about coal. To the extent that natural gas will displace coal, and I know we're talking about federal lands, but I've heard a lot of talk about China in particular, that, you know, China has apparently larger shale gas reserves than the U.S., and if they could economically tap the shale gas, it would really help the global environment. Is that something you guys have thought about?
Well, just from CAP's perspective, we have written quite a bit about gas as a bridge fuel and believe it is an important source, but there are a variety of environmental concerns that need to be addressed. Obviously, improving the practice, drilling practices is very important. Siting development appropriately so you're not, you know, impeding with or encroaching on communities and protecting sensitive areas. And then I think there are some really big questions about methane emissions that I mentioned briefly associated with gas production that really haven't been solved yet. And the administration has taken on a methane initiative, and there'll be some rules aimed at cutting methane emissions. But so gas we see as an important fuel source, especially in the transition to a cleaner energy future. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done to improve practices.
And I think from our perspective, we don't really see it as a bridge fuel, mostly because all the stuff that needs to be done in order to get at the gas we supposedly have, and we have issues with how much gas we actually can access, and I can get you guys more information about that. But really, a bridge fuel talks about, you're talking about something short term, and what we're doing now with fracking is very long term. The infrastructure, now they're talking about building export facilities to send it overseas. I mean, you're talking about locking us in to many, many years into a practice that we find unsafe. So we don't see it as a short-term bridge fuel at all.
Are there any questions for the panelists? Yes. Does anybody want to address the question why no federal minimum standards?
Talk about something else you mentioned, and maybe somebody else can jump in the last part. But I think you're right. The law has and regulations have been lagging on federal lands. I think one reality, sadly, is that it takes a big crisis and a lot of public attention to create the impetus for reform. And you know, BOEM and Bessie and Honor are a great example. There's been a tremendous amount of work done in the last few years since Deepwater Horizon to change you know, not just the organization and but also to promulgate some new rules relating, working on a blowout preventer rule, and they're working, you know, they've improved a variety of things. Even their planning efforts for the offshore have become more toward targeted leasing, and so not saying, hey, we're going to lease the whole area, but we're going to go to a specific part of it. Now, look, onshore, we haven't, thankfully, had the scale of catastrophe from oil and gas. There have been a lot of spills and accidents, but they don't captivate the national interest in the same way that Deepwater Horizon did. And BLM, I would argue, is behind where Bessie and BOEM are in the offshore on their oil and gas regulations. And then you shift over to the BLM coal program, and it's a dinosaur. This was referred to a few minutes ago. I mean, there isn't a competitive leasing process anymore. There isn't, you know, large, broad landscape level reviews and plans for leasing. So I think there's a lot of work to do just within the federal family and within agencies of the Department of the Interior to look at best practices. What is it that BOEM is doing on graduated rental rates? And they've increased royalties offshore. Why aren't we doing that onshore?
Thank you.
I can add, you know, this is, and I feel the need to qualify this as my personal opinion. You know, I really look, generally I think the way our federal government is organized, we are fragmented. And, you know, you hear talk of national energy plans, and but they're really in my mind, and I don't think I'm alone here, there isn't a true, really looking out long-term energy plan. And, you know, you have a lot of different agencies that are in charge with parts of it. And, you know, your ability to, you know, advance the larger picture is really constrained by what your particular mandate is. And so I really think, you know, until, in my mind, balance is always the best. You know, balancing, don't put all your eggs into one basket or another. I'm not suggesting that they are. But until we get sort of federal government gets an overall plan and directive that we can all work toward, it's going to be hard to do that.
Can I just add something real? So just two things that I just want to mention and put out there is that there is a movement on the national level to close those loopholes, and I can get you more information about that. I mean, it's not going anywhere right in our particular Congress or last year's Congress, but there are some bills that would close some of the loopholes in those environmental laws, which I think if you're really wanting to get involved, you should definitely start, you know, working with those bills. I mean, that's a good place to start. And I also want to just clarify that there are, you know, you always hear there's no water contamination, nothing's tied to fracking, but there are communities that are suffering from fracking, and I've met some of the people and the survivors, and, you know, but they're not getting to the Hill. They're not getting into the national spotlight like BP's, that whole, like, offshore drilling disaster, right? So we need to, part of it is the people taking it upon themselves to really do the education to get those federal standards.
And if I can add one more thing, I mean, I think it's like anything else where consumer behavior drives what businesses do, and I think there's still a long way, you know, to go for people. You know, when you look at greenhouse gas emissions from, like, oil and all, where's the greatest emissions? It's the burning of it, the driving of the cars. You know, so it's consumer behavior, I think, is ultimately going to have the biggest influence.
I'll just add one thing. I mean, you know, Max Weber famously said that politics is a long, slow, boring of hard boards. It's, you know, we're not in an era unlike the 70s where broad environmental laws are likely to be passed. On the other hand, you know, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't commend the agencies that have responsibilities over these areas. You know, where they have the mandate to take scientific information into account, purely as a consumer, purely as an individual, I would say they do a pretty good job of it. So, you know, if there are ways to encourage, sort of small scale to encourage that in legislation, that might be a possibility. Obviously, as we all know, NEPA analysis is not a great remedy in the area of environmental law because at most it probably will delay action. But still, it does help to further the conversation. So.
Yes.
Working, but anyway, my name is Caitlin Buchanan. I'm a second year law student here. Thank you all very much for coming to this panel. It's been really interesting. I just have a pretty broad question for anyone. I'm wondering about the long-term outlook for fracking on federal lands. If we're talking about this as a bridge to renewables, as you know, this source is available now and we can get it cheaply, how long is that going to last from private industry perspective, what their outlook is, and then from government perspective as well. So thank you.
Well, yeah, I'm you know, that's a big question, but I'll just sort of start. I know, you know, offshore we do well stimulation. I mean, it's done to basically make the most use, get the most you can out of that. It's a completely different process than what's happening onshore. So I guess say that because I'm not really going to be able to contribute much to the fracking, you know, but I know there's, we're seeing confusion because people are also assuming it's happening offshore as well.
I think onshore, about 90% of wells on public lands are used fracking processes. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. It is the method that people are using to not only pursue new plays, but also to extract more oil and gas from existing plays. I think there's not a political will right now to go much further than what the BLM is proposing on fracking rules. So I think we'll see the current rule that's being proposed finalized. I think that will be a very heavy lift. There is a lot of work put into that particular rule. I think it'll be very tough to revisit. But absent kind of a national discussion over how fracking should happen or shouldn't happen on federal lands, I think we'll continue to see a lot of local discussion of whether people want fracking and more broadly oil and gas development on the public lands near them. I don't know if folks followed the controversy around the George Washington National Forest out in Virginia, but an initial forest plan there proposed to ban horizontal drilling and fracking in the forest. And it that proposal had a lot of support from local communities, but the industry said, hey, this is not the right approach. And we shouldn't be banning one particular practice that's involved in oil and gas production. The Forest Service went back and said, okay, we're going to go back to the traditional approach of just saying no new leasing and no new development of any kind, whether it's fracking or not, in the George Washington National Forest. And so the local advocates were happy with the result. It didn't end up being a decision that was focused on the fracking process. But I think that's the kind of thing we'll see a lot of debate over is, do people want the National Forest near them or the Bureau of Land Management areas near them? Do they want to see an expansion of oil and gas drilling in those areas? That's typically a debate we're seeing out west, but the GW forest decision was interesting in part because it was so close to Washington and affected the watershed of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so I think a lot of that covers what I was going to say, except for one of part of your question, and if I think I remember it correctly, is that you're wondering how long this will last, right? Like, are we talking about, so I don't think fracking, unfortunately, is going away anytime soon. You know, 90% of them are being fracked, the wells. But I think that there's a lot of policies now that are coming up to increase fracking with regards to, you know, the demand. So right now we're seeing a lot on the Hill and in perspective, these policies where they want to export the LNG gas from the United States and over to the global economies and sell it on the global market. And so, you know, it depends on what happens with that, right? Because if we do get those, if we do start exporting our natural gas, then it's going to lead to more fracking here. So, you know, that's sort of, and they're already building the infrastructure and getting that infrastructure approval.
Well, a number of export terminals have been approved.
Right. In fact, if you're interested, Maryland, there's been a huge fight with regards to the one at Cove Point, and we can, you know, anyone can ask more questions later about that.
Are there other questions?
I had a question, actually, for Jill. I know that there's been a lot of concern recently over opening the Arctic Circle for drilling and kind of the technological challenges there. And so I was wondering kind of what BOEM's perspective is on that and whether they are thinking about ways in which to deal with those challenges if they are actually going to open those areas for drilling.
Sure. Yeah, tons of thinking. Yeah, absolutely. I would point out that there are leases that have been let, and we're talking in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea. So there have been leases that have been let there already. In state waters in the Beaufort, there is some development that's happened, not in federal waters. You know, when you go over to the Chukchi, what you find are the resources are further offshore. The Chukchi is much shallower. It has a much further out. It stays shallow than in the, I'm getting too technical now. Let me just back it up a second. So leases do exist right there. You may be familiar, Shell has been up in the Chukchi trying to do some exploratory drilling. And basically exploratory drilling means they're going to look for where there may be possible sites to actually put a production facility in. So they have done that. Well, they've gone out. They had some problems when they went out. Their anchor of their for their drilling rig broke loose and it grounded. And so that caused a halt and everything and a review of all those actions. And we just actually put out, I think it was just this last week, some new standards, a proposed rule for standards for any sort of activity in the Arctic. Some of the stuff that we're requiring, and I'll talk about future leasing in a second. For example, if they're going to go and they're going to do more drilling, anybody, they're going to have a couple things. They have to have the capping mechanism on board to show that it can work versus like in Deepwater Horizon, you know, there were 40,000 wells that have been drilled in the Gulf of Mexico. No one anticipated that if it did go, it was going to be quite like that. And there was no capping mechanism available. There was no relief rig. So like in the Arctic, there will be a capping mechanism required, and also they have to bring a second drill. So what happens, and this was part of what went on in Deepwater, is you then drill into that reservoir, and then you try to stabilize the pressure so that the oil stays in. So there are things like that that are going to be likely required. They were for the Shell plan. They're in this proposed rule. And if they are finalized, those are some pretty big things that, that would help. There's also a lot going on with trying to study not only what spilled oil could do in the Arctic, but also how it could be cleaned up, how and if. You know, what ice does to clean up, you know, what kind of fuel or oil might be coming out. You have to know those kinds of things. Bessie is in charge of doing all the reviews on the oil spill response plan. So companies have to show that they have things, readily available infrastructure, all that stuff, which is, you know, exists up in the Beaufort to some extent, but in the Chukchi, it's kind of new. So they have to show they have all of those things in place. So there are, as I said, some existing things that have been leased. We had an environmental EIS that was sent back. We were sued on, and we had to make some corrections in our projections of how much recoverable oil was there, because then that affects your analysis overall. We've done that. And in this new plan that's being proposed, and again, this is just a draft, is there would be a sale in Cook Inlet in Alaska, which is not the Arctic, one in the Beaufort and one in the Chukchi. And so, again, all of those, it's proposed. It's open for comment. There are a number of areas that are it would not occur in up there because they're used for subsistence hunting, and so they're off the table. Hannah Shoals was pulled off the table in the Chukchi because it's an important biological area. And so and I think that the 193 lease sale basically even, you know, demonstrated that, you know, there's maybe overall, it's not a sure thing even if you get a lease. There's probably like, I think it actually uses 25% chance that something will actually get produced up there because there's a lot of things that have to happen, you know, in order to get to that point. So I don't know if that explains it, but we also, in this proposed sale, or in this proposed plan, the leases are pushed back a little bit into the plan as far as when they would occur so that there's enough time is allowed to really fully understand all the ecology, biology, all the response that that would need to happen.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about the global market and prices for oil and how that goes up and down and how that impacts oil and gas on federal lands and leasing and how this all fits together? Because the prices really do make a difference on how things occur, but there's this time lag. So could you talk a little bit about that?
I can maybe start so that others can fill in. Prices have a huge impact on trends on federal lands and waters. and it's funny. I mean, there's kind of an ongoing political fight in the Congress, and Congress going after the administration of accusing various administrations of trying to shut down oil and gas production on federal lands, and pointing to the last couple years, and this is up or, and that's down, and so you're either for oil and gas or you're against it. By and large, the market is driving trends in production on federal lands and waters, and industry's decisions about whether to develop leases that they already own are largely determined by things like rig availability, price, and all sorts of stuff. So we've seen a couple interesting things that I mentioned in the last few years. One is, you know, amid this big shale oil boom up in the Dakotas and down in New Mexico and elsewhere, that's been going wild. We've seen huge increases in production of federal lands in New Mexico in particular. Meanwhile, gas production has fallen some as gas prices have gone down. So companies are making the decision to shift their drilling operations toward oil plays, and a lot of those oil plays, with the exception of those areas in New Mexico, are on private and state lands. And then the second thing I'll mention is the up in the Arctic, Jill mentioned this, these Shell got into a lot of these leases at a different time in global markets, and now with oil prices much lower, you would think that's going to affect some of their future decisions. I know companies aren't making production decisions on a year-to-year basis. They have their own projections that go out 10, 20, 30 years. But still, you know, is producing oil in the Arctic Ocean and building production infrastructure in an Arctic climate, putting it into the pipeline there near Prudhoe Bay and shipping it down to the lower 40, is that a cheaper operation than investing in shale oil plays in the Dakotas or elsewhere? And I think the market has a huge impact on decisions on federal lands, and outside of the D.C. kind of political rhetoric, people understand that in D.C., you know, you'd think that President Obama has the, you know, turns on or off the spigot on federal lands, but that's just not true.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an economist, so I, you know, feel the need to qualify that. I think largely, you know, everything that is said is true. I know offshore, just because of the nature, you know, there's huge capital expenses. I mean, millions and sometimes into the billions of dollars just to produce, you know, one production facility to get to that point. So I am sure that the prices as they change, you know, are going to either pull things off the table or delay when a company may want to start. So it does, you know, have an effect. I also assume that they do sort of look at the long-term trends and they have to make decisions, you know, to sort of keep their businesses going. So I don't know. I don't have a whole lot more to add to that. I know if you look at, like, the draft proposed program, those websites I put up there, and even our EISs, we have huge sections just on the economics of it that probably would give you much greater detail than I can.
Any more questions? I just have one final question, and then, oh, I'm sorry. Do you have a question? Oh, I didn't see your hand. I'm sorry.
So a few of you hit on climate policy and also NEPA. And I'm sure you all are aware that CEQ put out some recent guidance on considering GHG emissions and climate change in the NEPA analysis, and also recognizing that, you know, climate change is a global problem and NEPA tends to deal with, most of the time, individual federal agency actions. So do you feel that the guidance that CEQ put out, or just the concept of dealing with climate change in the NEPA context, is appropriate, or is it helping the conversation? Or where do you kind of see the climate policy going in the future now that we have this guidance? Is that the right direction? Or do you think there are other avenues that, as a government, we could be, you know, kind of tackling to deal with climate policy at the kind of federal level?
Yeah, I can take that. I mean, I haven't had a chance to really study the new CEQ guidelines. But, you know, I think the CEQ guidelines are kind of a function of the limitations of the inherent statutory mechanism. So from my initial review of them, it seems like an important step. I mean, you know, cost should be considered. It's probably an improvement over the draft 2010 guidelines in some ways. Some of the sort of hortatory language is important. Whether, as a technical matter, it'll work, I think it just remains to be seen. But other than that, I don't really have a view yet.
I would just add what I talked about earlier is I think that's really important, but it is still really tough to make project-by-project or plan-by-plan decisions that properly account for the aggregated carbon and climate impacts of federal land management policy. And so at some other level, at some point in time, there will need to be a coordinated across federal agencies strategy for reducing carbon emissions. And that strategy and those goals that are set should inform decisions about the OCS. They should inform decisions about the coal program and BLM and fracking and how this happens. And it's a complicated task, but when it comes down to it, you know, the federal government has the information available to do it. It's not hard to come up with the accounting, you know, the current state of play with GHG emissions from public lands, or to measure the carbon implications of kind of planning decisions that could help you get to those targets or settings. So I think there will need to be a paradigm shift more broadly toward a kind of comprehensive carbon emissions reduction plan.
Any more questions? So my final question is more about the future of energy policy on federal lands. I know with the Energy Policy Act of 2005, they allowed the construction of wind turbines on decommissioned oil rigs. And I was wondering if each of you could kind of speak to your sector's opinion on the future of not necessarily extractive industries, but just of energy policy in general and renewable energy and how federal lands can play into our transition, hopefully eventually away from oil and gas.
I could start. I have a relatively simple comment, which is, you know, bring it on. I think it's a good process, and I hope it continues. So basically, again, my sector in this case would be sort of the private law firm sector rather than the sort of extractive industry sector. So,
I think longer term we will continue to see a ramp up of renewable energy production from federal lands. There'll be a build out of some of the projects that have been approved in the last few years on public lands, probably not all of them for a variety of reasons. But I think there already is a shift that we're seeing in the federal agencies toward not just an oil, gas, and coal focus, but programs that are starting to facilitate renewable energy development. Seeing projects on the ground onshore, BOEM has done incredible work offshore to do competitive lease sales in the Atlantic and to do that kind of an environmental analysis up front so they don't have to be done project by project and end up with a Cape Wind situation. The groundwork is being laid right now for a different energy mix coming off of federal lands. You know, in 5 years, will we be, you know, entirely shifted? No, of course not. But I think that mix will change over time, and it will be the result of both some decisions and plans coming from the Department of the Interior, but also some broader market forces that will affect demand for the supplies that are found on federal lands.
Yeah, so I think it really depends on where we want to go as a country and the political will, right? Because with all this stuff going on now, we're looking at now they want to export natural gas, which will increase fracking. And so I think, you know, what we really need to do is take a step back and see we have to transition. The science is telling us we have to transition to renewable energy. We need to do that. It's just how aggressive that transition is depends on, you know, the political will of everyone who's, you know, coming up with these policies. And so I think it's just like we need to take a step back and really like see where we want to go, because we know we have to get to this certain point. So the more renewables, right, the better, the more aggressive the transition as far as Food and Water Watch is concerned, the better.
Yeah, and I think from, you know, I mentioned, and it's, Matt brought that up too, but from BOEM, you know, we are managing both renewables and more conventional. And, you know, my personal opinion is, you know, diversifying more is a good thing. We have with the 2005 Energy Policy Act, which officially gave that ability to BOEM to pursue that, You know, that program has had the benefit of sort of being able to sort of plan first, and Matt brought that up, which is so now that we called it SMART from the start. So basically working with stakeholders along the Atlantic where there's the greatest potential right now for wind energy development, finding those areas that would be most suitable, that aren't going to conflict, getting those areas nominated, having competitive lease sales, you know, so I think you're going to see more and more of that build up. There's also some projects that are looking at, using currents and tides, and of course there's division between which agency you deal with depending on which kind of, you know, hydropower it is. But there's a lot of, so I think, you know, as these things get really start to come to fruition, we're going to see more and more of them. The Cape Wind example, we inherited that in BOEM, and, you know, with anything, there are still some environmental issues that impact issues that go even with wind and aesthetics, visual aesthetics, what people want to see or not see from their backyard is certainly one of them. So, you know, my hope is that, you know, with this other SMART from the start, that things will move along at a much more productive and faster rate just because of all that advanced planning. But I do think we're going to think it might be 10 years from now to really see the difference.
One thing I'd just add is I think it's interesting. We haven't talked at all about onshore hydropower. As I think everybody knows, dams in the West and the Northwest supply a huge amount. Dams from federal projects supply a huge amount of electricity for Western markets. And we really haven't talked a whole lot about the benefits and some of the costs associated with those hydropower projects. I think there's an effort by some folks to begin to think about kind of deadbeat dams that aren't actually producing electricity anymore. And I think there's a set of policy questions around hydropower on federal lands that are really interesting and that probably deserve to come back into focus here in the coming years.
Did you say deadbeat dams? Never heard that before. Oh.
Yeah.
Learn something new.